Hi guys, my name is Greg Knox, and these are the worst date movies ever. On the show today, me and my guest, Miroslava Hartmann, are discussing the Australian film Romper Stomper, the film that launched Russell Crowe's career in Hollywood and all that great stuff. And if that wasn't enough, you've got a special interview with me, yes, me, by Miroslava, because there's nothing more self-indulgent than someone being interviewed on their own show, after all. Seriously, though, it's a really, really good show. It's definitely one of the best I've ever done, and I hope that you enjoy it very much in these difficult times.
So, welcome to the end times, Greg.
Yeah, I know. It's quite a thing, isn't it, that we're living in? We're living in sort of a post-apocalyptic society.
Well, it's not quite at that stage, I would argue. But, but since the world is upside down, I thought it would be fun for us to turn the tables and for me to interview you. How does that sound?
That sounds awesome. Yeah, yeah, sure. There's nothing more egotistical and self-indulgent than having the host be interviewed by someone else on their own show. So I thought, why not? Fuck it. Who cares?
Why not? Indeed. So, you know, first things first, how are you going to use this time of global pandemic, quarantine and self-isolation?
Well, I mean, I'm still at work, so I'm not going to work as such. I'm working from home, but like at this moment, like pretty much what I'm doing is, you know, working from home as best I can, still trying to keep in shape. They haven't closed the gyms down yet, although I'm sure they will eventually. So I'm trying to go to the gyms at an unsociable time so that there's not that many people there, so I can still kind of social distance and all that great stuff. And yeah, I'm sort of using the time as best I can to do what I always do, which is watch lots and lots of lovely films, which is pretty much how I spend most of my life.
And how many films do you actually have in your collection? Because you're quite a big fan of the physical copy.
I am. I've been collecting films since about 2008, 2009. And before that, I used to collect CDs. So I still do. It's not here. It's at my parents' place. But I have a huge CD collection. I've got about 300 or 400 CDs at my parents' still. So yeah, I've got about, I would say, 1,000, probably closer to like 800 or 900. But yeah, quite a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays. I tend to try and get sort of, I don't know, I'm kind of more of a DVD fan than Blu-ray. I only get Blu-ray necessarily when I have to, because I like uniformity, because I'm one of those people.
Well, we're going to talk about that, aren't we? First question is, you know, I thought it might be nice to start at the beginning. I mean, we don't need to do a whole David Copperfield thing, but
well, we can
what
do,
is the first... I think there's enough there for us to do a David Copperfield on you, however. The question is, what is the first film that you remember watching and loving? Because your wonderful father, Ron, he's got a bit of a relationship with cinema and music and all that, hasn't he? So was it something that maybe he introduced you to, or helpfully recorded straight from TV, or...
So I don't remember when I was a child what the first film that I ever saw was. Like, a lot of people can remember, like, oh, I remember when I was a child and the first film that I saw was this. I can't. I remember going to the cinema with my parents and stuff, but the first film I remember really liking is The Usual Suspects, which is a very controversial film to like nowadays, unfortunately, due to actual and possible alleged indiscretions by the director and one of the members of the cast in that film. And it's a very weird cast anyway. You've got Stephen Baldwin. It's like the only even remotely good film that Stephen Baldwin ever made. And you've got, you know, other actual good actors in there, like Gabriel Byrne and Kevin Spacey and Benicio del Toro, Pete Postlethwaite, people like that. And it was just the first film that I ever saw which had a massive twist in it. Like, the twist, I mean, everyone probably knows the twist now, but at the time, like, there was no internet, there were no spoilers, so it was just, I saw it and it blew my mind. And literally what I wanted to do is I wanted to watch the film again straight away afterwards. And I've seen it, must be at least 20 times over my life.
Wonderful. And of course, you know, one thinks about, for example, Agatha Christie's Mousetrap. And it's amazing how for decades the dramatic and literary establishment actually succeeded in keeping the ending secret by having like a gentleman's pact with the press not to reveal, you know, the ending, so that subsequent viewers can enjoy it for themselves. I mean, that just does not happen anymore. The best that we get it is a spoiler alert warning, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favourites is Alfred Hitchcock for Psycho. In the trailer for Psycho, he said, don't give away the ending of the film, don't give away the secret. And I think it was either Psycho or another film released around the same time where they had the gimmick of that once the film had started, no one would be allowed into the film to see it because, you know, you have to get your hair on time, you know, if you want to have the twist at the end and stuff like that. So yeah, it's I get what you mean. We don't really get these kind of films nowadays. It's a very 90s thing to get all these sort of twisty kind of thrillery type films. Like around the same time there was Seven, Silence of the Lambs, although it doesn't have a twist in it.
So. What's in the box?
No, it's more the twist as to who the killer was, because when the first time I saw it, I had no idea that Kevin Spacey was in it.
Kevin Spacey
was in a lot of really, really good films in the 90s and in the early 2000s. Like, obviously, he's in American Beauty.
Obviously.
And he's in,
that has a twist.
Yeah, all these films. So.
That's true. Why do you love film? Why film?
That's a very, very good question. It's a very deep philosophical question that you've thrown at me there. I guess what it is, mainly, is that I like kind of being transported into these other worlds. I think that's probably what it is. So I'm not, but in my kind of frame of reference, so a lot of people they'll say that and it's like, oh, I like watching kind of these nice kind of fantasy films, or they're geeks and they like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or whatever. Whereas I'm kind of very different. So I'm a lot more attracted to sort of drama films, horror films, thrillers, more psychological type films, or crime films, film noir sort of. So I like films that are kind of, I don't know, a reflection of kind of my personal point of view, I guess, in a lot of ways. So I don't know. I get a lot more out of watching films than I do out of anything else. I used to watch TV a lot. Like, I used to watch TV all the time when I was a teenager. That was basically all I did in my spare time. And I watched all kinds of stuff. I even watched trashy stuff like Big Brother and Temptation Island and stuff like that. Just anything like which was fascinating from a TV perspective. And I was interested in like the history of TV. So, yeah, it's just something I've kind of always been into. And then I stopped liking films for a while, and then I got into films in 2007. So basically there were two films that came out at the same time, which are two of the best films of like the decade in my opinion. So there's No Country for Old Men and There'll Be Blood. They came out literally in the cinemas here about a week apart from each other, and I saw them at the cinema. Literally, I saw There'll Be Blood with about four other people who were all really old. I don't think they really understood the film, but no, I really loved it, and No Country for Old Men as well. So I think from there, I kind of got into more sort of serious kind of film watching, and I started getting Empire magazine, and kind of from there, they had an issue, which was the 500 greatest films of all time, and I sort of made it my mission to kind of watch all 500 films on that list, which I did, and I had a lot of fun doing it as well. It was a kind of a good mix of kind of popular and kind of art house type films. And that was kind of my first exposure to a lot of art house cinema. And then through meeting your good self.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we started doing the 1001 movies you have to see before you die list, and that was in 2011. So
Yeah.
you had
Do you remember the
already,
first film that we watched
of
together?
course, we watched The Blue Angel with Marlene
Der
Dietrich.
Blaue Engel
Der
by
Blaue
Joseph
Engel.
von Sternberg.
Yeah, that was a great
Yeah.
film to start with. And actually, we approached this very systematically, I'm proud to say. We had an Excel spreadsheet that
Of course.
we, where we had two columns. There was me, I think. What was my color? Was it? I think
I
yours.
can't even remember what my color was. I think it was either blue or green. I think yours was red, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. And then we marked all the films that we had respectively seen by that point. And you had already seen so many of those films, having done the Empire 500 list. But I think we must have seen, I mean, over the years, hundreds of film together.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, it's one of our favorite things to do, even across kind of one side of Europe to the other.
Yeah, very much so. And the geographical distance is no obstacle. For instance, you coming to support the HR Giga 40th anniversary of the Alien movie show that I curated in Kiev, that was amazing. And we also went to Nuremberg together, where you went to see the film museum while
I did, yeah.
I met up with a good friend of mine. And yeah, there's all sorts of, I think, film related travel that you've undertaken. I mean, can you think of some trips, some examples?
I mean, I've been to New York a couple of times. New York is a very kind of famous city. Literally, wherever you go in New York, is somewhere has there's been a film made there somewhere. So I went to Brooklyn. I've been to Manhattan a lot of times. Obviously, I love Woody Allen. Woody Allen's one of my favorite directors, so to be able to go to Manhattan is always a great thing. Don't care what he's done. Again, I like really controversial directors, so I like Bryan Singer, I like Woody Allen, Roman Polanski, I like him as well. You got to judge the art, not the artist in these things,
Is that
people.
how it works?
Even whatever it is they allegedly have done, yeah.
What about Harvey?
Oh, he's kind of different though. So he's not, I mean, he was a piece of shit anyway. I mean, irrespective of kind of what he's done, and he definitely did it, and he's definitely a massive, massive piece of shit for doing what he did. And he's gonna die in prison, hopefully. But even before that, I mean, he's done a lot of very, very bad things, like editing films without the permission of directors, pushing these mawkish, sentimental kind of foreign films sort of on the American public, which they now think are like these really, really good films when they're not at all. Like Life is Beautiful, and films like that, just like, just no good, no good. I mean, his brother, he's still a prick as well, but at least he kind of was successful. I read a book about Miramax and kind of American independent cinema in the 90s, and yeah, Harvey was never a nice person even back then, and obviously the truth has kind of come out sort of since then about his other behavior, shall we say. But yeah. I mean, he's still really Pulp Fiction, or all of Quentin's films up to the last one, and still released a lot of really cool films from the 90s and stuff. But one, he basically rigged the Oscars. Like Shakespeare in Love only won Oscars because of him, basically. So, what can you say?
What can you say? I mean, you do have an encyclopedic knowledge of film, and you've kind of made it your life's mission to watch every single film ever made, it sometimes feels like. I mean, you completed 1001 movies in, it must have been like the mid 2010s, right?
Yeah, I think it was in about 2016 that I finished it. So we started it at the end of 2011. And I mean, hey, once you get your mind to something, it's worth sort of seeing it through to the end. And so that's basically what I did. So luckily, there is only a new version every year. And what they do is they kind of add new films, but they get rid of some of the less good newer films that they added in previous versions. They don't tend to get rid of the older films. So basically that's what they did. So yeah, luckily I've been able to do that a few times. So I'm quite proud of myself for that one.
Well done you. That deserves a round of applause. And I'm still way behind. I think I've done a third. And I think that's kind of more than your average Joe. But I'm well, well low on my 1950s and earlier viewing. I mean, there's a ton of films from the kind of 30s, 40s and 50s that I need to see. So that's a category that, you know, I'm going to be giving more attention to. You've made no secret of the fact that you have Asperger's syndrome, and some might say that this gives you almost an unfair advantage when it comes to being a self-styled film expert. Can you comment on why that makes you an ideal candidate for the job?
The job of hosting a podcast about film?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I mean, people on the spectrum, they do have like a passionate sort of narrow interest. That's one of the traits of someone on the spectrum, shall we say. So, yeah, mine happens to be film. And yeah, there are things about Asperger's syndrome that are not great and that I wouldn't wish on any kind of neurotypical person. But there are aspects that do help me out. So there are aspects of, you know, having Asperger's that help me in my day-to-day job that I do to make money, to be able to do things like this. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, my interest, when I meet other people who have kind of a similar kind of passion for film, we have obviously a lot of things that I can talk about. And it's not as if I only like horror movies, or I only like Disney films, like some people, or I only like, I don't know, I'm trying to think really obscure film, like only like, I don't know, musicals, or I only like, I don't know, sort of costume dramas, for example. Like, I mean, I've seen, because, you know, through watching all these different films, it gave me there's films in, so Miley's favorite genre of film is like musicals, but there are musicals that I've seen since kind of watching all the films that I have that I now really like Singing in the Rain and films like that. So yeah, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, yeah, films of that nature. But I mean, there's other kind of lists that I've kind of done since then that have helped me out a lot. So I've done IMDb did a list of kind of top 500 horror movies, and I finished that literally a week ago. So go me for that. There's an online list called They Shoot Pictures, Don't They, which is updated every year. And again, it's like a top 1001 films list, and I managed to complete that about a month ago. So yeah, sorry, to actually answer your question, yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do when I kind of started doing podcasts is I want to be entertaining, which I hope I am. I do my best to be entertaining, as you know. I try not to bore the shit out of a listener as best I can. But what I also wanted to do is I also wanted to kind of be informative. Like, I didn't want to be kind of one of those kind of film channels or film podcasts where people have only seen films kind of up to about 1970 and they haven't seen anything before that, or they haven't really seen a lot of films. They don't really have a lot of comparisons to kind of draw when they talk about films. So I wanted to be the complete opposite of that. So I think that I have an advantage over other people who do this kind of film podcast, where instead of going like, oh, I'm doing a show on Cannibal Holocaust and it's really gory and there's all these killings in it and there's animal deaths and, oh, you know, isn't it brutal? You know, I can actually talk about it in a lot more depth and in a lot more sincerity. So yeah, that's why I think I qualify, goddammit.
Well, I think another aspect that we should mention is the fact that you've pretty much seen a film from every single corner of the globe. Like, you have a lot of geographical scope when it comes to the sort of films that you have seen. I mean, what would you say is your kind of favourite national cinema? You know, your favourite kind of non-Hollywood cinema, even?
Well, I mean, I guess it would have to be Italian film, because I've seen so many fucking Italian films, particularly Italian horror films. So There's the Jallo, which I went for a phase of for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months where I literally only watched Jally, like one a day or something along those lines. So I know a lot about my Italian cinema. Watched a lot of Italian horror films other that aren't Jallo. And yeah, I mean, just through film history, you know, I've seen films, you know, by Rossellini, Antonioni, Visconti, Bertolucci, Sergio Leone, and even kind of more modern kind of Italian films like The Great Beauty and I Am Love and Suspiria and, you know, yeah, films like that. You know, yeah, I did take a big dump on sort of Life is Beautiful earlier, but yeah, you know, yeah, I mean, Italian films are probably my favourite if I had to choose one, but I mean, you know, generally I like a lot of different national cinemas, so I like obviously Sweden, although, well, it's mostly Bergman that I like, but yeah, Sweden, Japan, Korea, there's a lot of really, really good stuff coming out of Korea over the last 20 years or so. France, Australia, which we're going to talk about in a bit.
Yay!
So there's good films basically coming out all over the world, not just America or the UK, you know, so it's up to you to kind of not be kind of a reverse snob and just, yeah, watch as much of it as you can, or at least watch just the good stuff, because the good stuff is, you know, fucking great.
Well, that really should be put on mugs and coasters. The good stuff is fucking great, Greg Knox. So I want to talk a little bit about your broadcasting experience. So let's get the facts straight. So you're currently working on a podcast called Worst Date Movies Ever, which this interview is going to be a part of.
You've been on it a few times.
I've been on it a few times. Yeah. Before that, you hosted a podcast called The Labyrinth.
Yeah, so I'll start from the beginning.
But
so,
also, wait. But also, and tell me if I got this right, you got fired from Croydon Radio?
Yeah, so what happened was I started off helping out my friend Tom Cannon, who's appeared on this podcast a few times. He had a radio show called The Saturday Show, very original name because it was on a Saturday afternoon. And basically his show could be about whatever he wanted it to be about because it was very kind of general. So every month or so I would appear on his show and talk about films. So it was generally, this is what's out in the cinema at the moment, let's talk about it. I did that for about a year. And then they had an opening in Croydon Radio for people to do their own show if they wanted to. So I decided to start my own show. So I did it every month. It's called The Labyrinth. And the first show I did was absolutely terrible because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. And, you know, when you're live on the air, you know, you kind of get very self-conscious about stuff like not swearing and, you know, being entertaining, even if you're by yourself. Like, doing a fucking show by yourself is so hard. Like, I have a lot of respect for anyone who does any kind of radio or podcast and just does it by themselves. It's just, yeah, it's not easy. And anyway, what happened was I was doing a show and what we got told to do is, you know, this is in the early days of Twitter, we got told you have to plug the show on Twitter, like, you know, at the start of the show, and you have to do all this stuff on social media. So I went on social media and I posted this thing on Twitter that said, you know, The Labyrinth, it's online, listen now, motherfuckers. So I said that, not thinking anything of it. So it was very sarcastic because I have a very sardonic kind of sense of humour. Didn't think anything of it, like I said, and then about 2 or 3 days later I got a email from the owners of the station saying that they had to fire me because I had sworn on social media. So yeah, that was kind of embarrassing. But then what made it even funnier, because that, you know, it was just social media, I didn't swear on the air, I was still allowed to do Tom's show. So I appeared on Tom's show and I can't really remember what we were talking about. I couldn't think. So what happened was I was trying to think of something, and you know when you're not really controlling what you're saying because you're trying to think so much, you're dedicating all your energy to that. So basically I said, oh, what the fuck is it? Or something like that on the air. And it's like, well, I can't really deny that I did that. So I was just like, I guess I'm fucked again. So I got fired again. So I got fired twice from the same show, from the same station.
From arguably one of the classiest stations in London. So that's your foul mouth for you.
Well, so this is why I've, you know...
You've gone rogue.
This is why I've upgraded to doing my own show, just because I can just, you know, swear as much as I want, and it's great, and I can't get fired. It's awesome. And then after that, I decided to do a podcast called The Lament Configuration with Reoffend. So I wanted to do a podcast on horror films. Basically, my plan was, when I was doing The Labyrinth, to do a whole year of shows on the Video Nasties. So... it was kind of just something I wanted to do. I kept this idea in my head about doing these Video Nasty shows, and I met Rhea through a mutual friend, Mr. Tom Dennett Cook, who has appeared on this show many times, mostly to talk about Nazis. But yeah, we decided to do a podcast together, and I did that for about a year and a half, and yeah, it was very, very rewarding. Again, that started off okay. I, you know, some of those early episodes of the show I can't really listen to because they're quite cringeworthy, but we got much, much better as we went on. And then we stopped doing that. And yeah, just wanted to do my own podcast. So here I am. I'm doing my own podcast on controversial movies and bad date movies. The whole worst date movies thing is something that I had an idea of about 8 years ago. It was just some random thing that I posted on Facebook back when I actually did post on social media. So I did this random list on Facebook of kind of bad date movies. And the idea is obviously, it's ironic in case you didn't notice. Like, obviously, I'm not suggesting that someone watch like Salo or Irreversible or Last House on the Left on a date. I mean, you can do that if you want, but you know, you have to be with a very understanding person, shall we say, if that's what you're going to do. So, yeah, been doing that ever since.
So what exactly is a bad date movie? I think this is a question that we've puzzled over every single time that we've done a show together.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating because what my idea of a worst date movie is and what other people's idea of a worst date movie is very, very different. So I'm quite desensitized to a lot of gore and kind of depressing content. So I can watch Requiem for a Dream and not really feel that bad afterwards, but I understand obviously a lot of people can't do that, and that's fine, you know, that's on them. But I mean, to me, a bad date movie is just basically a movie that's violent or depressing or has got kind of questionable content in it. It could even be a movie that's kind of very, very political. So, for example, I saw the remake of Black Christmas not that long ago. Now, that movie is not a very good movie, and it's very woke, in inverted commas. And that might be a very, very bad date movie for someone who maybe doesn't share the same political ideology as the film does. So that could be a bad date movie, or a film could be a bad date movie, not because of any of those reasons. It could just be like someone who's not really into art house films. So I love Tarkovsky. So my favorite Tarkovsky film is Stalker, but I understand that obviously someone who's not into films like that will obviously hate Stalker, and they will think that I'm a pretentious prick and not really want to sort of, you know, be with me. So I know that could be a bad date movie as well. So it kind of varies from person to person. But basically what I wanted to do is, having done a show which is basically all horror movies, you know, I love horror movies. Horror movies are kind of my favorite type of films to talk about. But I don't want to restrict myself to just horror films. Like, if I wanted to do a show on, I don't know, I'm just plucking, well, like Come and See, like we did, for example. Now, Come and See is one of my favorite films of all time. But I couldn't do it on The Lament Configuration because it's a war film. So, yeah, that's why I decided to do it in this format. And, yeah, I mean, certain films get more views and listens than others. You know, the ones that you would think get more listens, if that makes sense. So, yeah, but no, and it's cool. It's my own show. I have basically 100% creative control, which is great. if I want to record, I can record. You know, I just kind of got to the point where, although I have people on the show most of the time, I don't like having to rely on another person so much. You can read into that whatever you want. So, yeah, no, I'm really enjoying it. It's been cool, sort of, you know, this is been very, very rewarding for me so far.
Well, tell us about some of the people who have been co-hosting the show with you. So you have a number of sort of returning co-presenters, don't you? I mean, what's the system there?
So basically, the idea was that I would only have people do one show and that's it. And what happened with that was, so essentially I'm very shy is kind of more my point. So I know a small group of people, so yourself, Tom Cannon, Tom Dennett Cook, Scott Priestley, and I mean I've asked a couple of other people who would be good for the show who haven't done it yet, but I mean I have a very small kind of collection of friends who, oh, and Carl Rowland as well, I should mention that he did a show as well, Freddy Got Fingered, that cinematic masterpiece. But yeah, the idea was to kind of originally expand beyond that. So I had a lady called Lucy Buglis, who has a blog called Lucy Goes to Hollywood, who I met through Twitter. She's one of the only people I've met through Twitter who I don't hate now or find really annoying. But yeah, she was cool enough to have me on her podcast, and I had her on mine. We talked about a film called Excision, which was really good. And yeah, the idea was to get people who aren't my friends to kind of come on, and I tried doing that and it didn't really work. I tried to get someone on my show who basically messed me around for about 2.5 months, and that's kind of made me wary of trying to talk to people I don't trust or don't know. So maybe that will change in the future, but yeah, so that's kind of why I only have my friends on. But even then, there are films that I want to talk about and I can't talk about them with other people because they're so horrific. So, for example, when I did the Vomit Gore trilogy, there was no way I'd be able to convince anyone to do that with me unless they were kind of willing to kind of watch 4 hours of people throwing up. Which, in fairness, those films are not literally that, but that's kind of the selling point of the film, is you've got people vomiting for a lot of it. And it's an acquired taste, I'll put it that way, but yeah, so.
Is that a taste that you've acquired in the process of preparing that episode? Because I listened to all of that, and I think this was during a Christmas holiday or something. I did, yeah, and I was amazed, like you were talking about how difficult it is to sort of to fly solo, you know, to present a show all on your own. You did brilliantly well. You just completely, you know, plowed through that.
Yeah, vomited through. Yes,
it was entertaining. I'll tell you that much.
Oh, cool. Thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
I suppose many listeners are wondering, why do you like messed up films so much? Because tell us about some of the films that you've already tackled on this podcast.
So I really like video nasties. I've always been attracted to films that were banned in some way or taboo. So The Exorcist was banned in this country up until about the early 2000s. So that was a film that I heard a lot about and I'd never seen it, so I built it up in my head. And it was the same with like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was the same with, you know, other films that have been banned or censored in this country for whatever reason. So through that, I just really, really, really wanted to see them. And I don't know, for whatever reason, I've always been attracted to kind of horror films or violent films or films with kind of taboo subject matter. And it's the same with music as well. Like, I've liked kind of metal and kind of not just like normal metal. I mean, like extreme metal that I've liked since I was a teenager and stuff. So stuff like that is just, that's just what I like. And it's, you know, I'm very, very difficult to shock these days. I think I would say I'm kind of nigh on impossible to shock. I think there's probably very, very few things that you could show me that would actually genuinely shock me nowadays, bar like and those stuff that I'm not even going to mention, you know, but there's, but yeah, I don't know. It's just me is the short answer to that. There's not really anything I can kind of, no, there's no real justification that I can give it other than I just find the movies interesting. And then, yeah, I watched the, you know, all the 72 video nasties for the Lament configuration. And from there, yeah, here I am. I'm kind of making, you know, podcasts about sort of these really fucked up movies. I mean, in terms of the worst films that I've seen, I mean, the Vomit Gore trilogy is pretty, pretty bad. The August Underground trilogy is pretty bad as well for different reasons. Especially the second one. The second one is very, very kind of difficult to watch. I mean, there's a cannibal film, so Cannibal Holocaust comes up a lot, and that is the most shocking by far of those kinds of films, although Cannibal Ferox is probably the most gory. Although they're all kind of upsetting because of the animal cruelty. Anything with really, you know, sadistic kind of rape scenes in it, so the uncut version of I Spit on Your Grave is very difficult to watch. At least I found it difficult to watch anyway. Irreversible was very difficult to watch for that reason, although it's only because of like that kind of scene that's difficult to watch. The rest of the film is actually fine to watch. Yeah, just any of those kind of films are just, yeah, horrible. I mean, a lot of films that came out in the 2000s as part of the torture porn movement are so hard to watch. Not just because of kind of what happens, it's just because of the tone of the films. They're just unrelenting and they have no happy endings. Like, at least in like I Spit in Your Grave and Last House on the Left, all the horrible people die at the end, so it's fine. So you're kind of redeemed at the end. Whereas in something like Eden Lake, it has no happy ending. That film is just miserable to watch. I couldn't imagine having to watch that again. Or something like Martyrs, which I love Martyrs, don't get me wrong, but I've only seen it once and I'm kind of almost too scared to watch it again because it was such a brutal experience the first time. So, but yeah, I'm rambling now. So, yeah, all those kind of films.
No, not at all. I mean, would it be fair to say that what you call worst eight movies ever on the show is in fact another way of saying, you know, challenging cinema?
Well, yeah. So, for example, I mean, me and Tom Dennett Cook did a show on The Holy Mountain by Alejandro Jodorowsky. Now, that's not upsetting or disturbing. There's imagery in it that's kind of disturbing, but that's more kind of, it's weird rather than fucked up. So, if it was up to, well, it's up to me. What was I going to say? It's my show. But yeah, I would like to do some David Lynch stuff. I would like to do some super, super weird kind of esoteric art, you know, proper experimental art house stuff. But, you know, there's only so much you can kind of cover by yourself. You know, you can't really say to someone, yeah, can we watch a really weird sort of hour? No, like something like, I don't know, Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Oh, that's a great movie. Would be
quite an interesting one to do.
Yeah, I love that.
But yeah.
So, I mean, where are you at with your podcast?
So, where I'm at is, this episode is going to be kind of the last episode of the second series. I'm not opposed to the idea of continuing the podcast in some form, but what I want to do is I want to move to YouTube full-time, and I want to do kind of video essays and stuff like that, because that is more interesting to me. Now, it's a lot more work, because literally with this stuff, all I have to do is watch films, make notes, and just press record on sort of, you know, my equipment that I've got here, and I can watch, you know, I can just record, and then sort of an hour later, you know, just do post-production, which hopefully doesn't take too long, do editing, etc. But as with video stuff, you obviously have to edit the video, so it will take me a lot longer, but I like the idea of doing stuff like that. I don't think anything like what I want to do has been done in terms of extreme cinema. There is a channel that's quite well known where I've made fun of it a few times, but it's essentially like, oh, there's this gory film, and then this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and isn't it sick, guys? It's really disgusting, guys. It's disturbing. And it's like, there's not really a lot to that, in my opinion, so I actually want to talk about these films properly, in inverted commas. So that's kind of what I want to do at some point, but it's, you know, I need to learn how to edit video, I need to get a better computer, because my computer, I love it, but I've had it for nearly 10 years and, you know, there's not a lot of hard disk space on there now. So yeah, it's just that's where the channel is going. It's just finding the time to do all that. And I think what I might do as well is I might do the podcast kind of side by side with the video, try and build my brand and all that kind of lovely kind of speak.
What do you mean by that? So you'd be, you know, accompanying a podcast discussing a film with a video essay on the film, or?
Yeah, so the idea would be, so I would do a video. So for the video, I would have to write a script as to what I'm going to say so I can tie the video around it. But as well as that, what I could do is with the script, I can kind of do a podcast as well around the sort of same material. So let's say I did a video on, let's say, the films of David Lynch, just for the sake of argument. So let's say I wanted to cover his entire filmography. So I could write a script and kind of do it that way for the podcast, for YouTube, and kind of put video together, etc. But then what I could do is at the same time, maybe even literally with the same audio, I could record like an audio podcast and do it that way as well. So I'm covering kind of both ends of the spectrum. There are podcasts that I like. So I don't listen to movie podcasts. I only really listen to wrestling podcasts. And there's a wrestling podcast that I listen to that has a video and an audio podcast. So they're literally the same. It's just, you know, there's the obvious difference. So
okay, lastly, what advice would you give someone who wants to broaden their knowledge of film?
Well, you can do what I did. Watch a lot of films. Watch a fuckload of films is the short answer. In terms of to actually broaden your knowledge, what I would do is to kind of pick a list, not necessarily the type of lists that I go for, which have got like 1,000 films on them. Basically, I don't know, the long answer, I guess, is to kind of try and find lists on YouTube that have films on that you've seen already and that you like, that this person who created the list thinks that you'll like as well, and kind of go from there. A lot of it is just trial and error. Like, for example, I only got into old films because literally there were these two Alfred Hitchcock films on BBC Two one Saturday afternoon, and I had nothing better to do, so I watched them, and I was really, really entertained by them. One was The Lady Vanishes, and I think the other was The 39 Steps. So, literally, I'd never seen, like, any other Hitchcock films apart from, like, Psycho before. I certainly hadn't seen any films from the 30s. And, yeah, just through that, that's kind of how you start. And it's the same with, kind of, subtitle films. It's like, okay, well, like, horror films, so, you know, started watching, you know, subtitled horror films, like, you know, The Ring and... what else is there at the time? Man Bites Dog, which I really like. That was another film I got into quite early on, which was not English, that was controversial. Yeah, just basically do that. Just basically pick a list that has some films on that you like already and some films that you've never heard of that are similar, and kind of just go from there.
Excellent. Is there anything else at all we haven't covered that you would like to add, since this is, after all, your podcast?
Well, I mean, obviously, I want to thank everyone for listening who has listened to any one of my shows. I appreciate, really, that, you know, I'm not good with the whole social media thing. I just, I kind of find it kind of beneath me in a kind of a way. I don't know, I'm loathed to do it just because I think it's shit and I hate social media. I especially hate Twitter because it's full of wankers. But basically, if you have found my podcast, then thank you very much for listening to it. I really appreciate it. I want to thank you very much for interviewing me. It's been a fun interview, kind of going through kind of my history and stuff like that. Yeah, just do stay tuned to the channel. As I said, I do have some kind of interesting stuff planned along the way. I'm going to probably do, you know, shows kind of like the ones I've done already. I'll do more shows with Tom. I'll do more shows with Miroslava and what have you. But yeah, the idea is to do kind of more kind of in-depth stuff. So yeah, stay tuned to the channel. Stay safe, everyone. You know, yeah, seriously, actually, you should really stay safe, you know, social distancing and all that. Don't, you know, bulk buy toilet paper if you don't need it. Unless, you know, if you're buying that much toilet paper, you know, you must obviously have problems. You know, you need to go to a doctor for that, clearly.
Well, so. Now is as good a time as any to catch up on one's podcast. So where can people go if they want to find out more about you?
So I have a Twitter page, which is at Worst Date Movies. You can find me on there. I've not posted on there for ages, but that is kind of where, if I do decide to post anything, it will be. If you're listening to this now, then obviously you'll know that the podcast is on iTunes, it's on Stitcher, it's on Spotify, it's on Google, it's on YouTube as well. That was one of the things that kind of I learned from the Lament configuration. There's a lot of people who wanted to listen to the show who reoffend you, basically said, well, I don't like Apple, don't want to use iTunes, so can you put it on YouTube? And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And I did, and I get a lot of traffic through YouTube that I don't get through, you know, your typical kind of podcast network. So anyone who's listening to this on YouTube, you know, I do really appreciate it. A total random person, you know, hey, leave me a comment. Give us a subscribe, guys. Give us a like.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Greg.
That's all right. Anytime. The film we are here to talk about today is Romper Stomper. It's directed by Jeffrey Wright and came out in 1992. Now, Romper Stomper is a film that belongs to a couple of different categories of film that I wanted to talk about. So the first one of those is the skinhead film, of which there are not actually that many, but there are still skinhead films coming out. Well, now, basically, there was one, is Imperium, with Daniel Radcliffe.
Daniel Radcliffe between...
Not that long ago.
...trying to be a corpse in Swiss Army Man and, you know, broadening his acting portfolio otherwise to try and prove that he's not just Harry Potter, plays an American cop who goes undercover as a skinhead recruit.
Yeah, so that's... There's about two or three different versions of the skinhead story. That's sort of basically one of them. So there's sort of person who's not a horrible racist who goes undercover to make other horrible racists think he's a horrible racist. And then there's the, I guess, person who is a skinhead who then basically discovers that their way of doing things is bad. So, i.e. American History X, so it's the reformed skinhead. Mm-hmm. And American History X, I guess, the most well-known version of this type of film. It's a great film. It's an amazing film.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the more interesting films of the late 90s, I feel like. That's really Edward Furlong at his peak. I discovered, actually, that the director of American History X, Tony Kaye, is a British filmmaker who directed a number of music videos for well-known artists like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. That was quite an unusual discovery, because it's a film that is so firmly associated with, you know, with the American cinematographic and kind of ideological landscape, and it's made, you know, such an impact. And like the curb stomping scene is probably, you know, in every single list of most disturbing scenes in films, you know, along with like the rape scene in Irreversible and countless others. And of course, American History X is said to have been based on Romper Stomper, albeit transporting it from suburban blue collar Melbourne to, is it LA?
I think so. It's been a long time since I've seen it. So we got that, and then we have the British version, which is obviously you've got This Is England, So this is England, directed by Shane Meadows, which has got an absolutely amazing performance by Stephen Graham in it. Absolutely incredible. And before that, you had Made in Britain with Tim Roth, which is, again, an amazing film. That seems to be kind of a way to kind of get ahead kind of in acting circles, is basically play a racist skinhead character.
It's certainly... it's on the bucket list, isn't it, for every great actor. It certainly has been for Russell Crowe. I mean, arguably, this is the role that launched him, that really put him in the view of serious film studios, because I was amazed. I once tried to watch every single Russell Crowe film ever made, and honestly, I just gave up. He's done so much. I even watched a film called The Sum of Us from around the same time, so we're talking early 90s Australian kind of domestic cinema, and in it he plays a loving son who is also gay, and it's kind of like a family drama. There's a lot in there, but he does a great job. What can I say? Like, Russell Crowe is exceptionally versatile, and I don't just mean the fact that he's an actor and a musician and a fighter.
And he's fighting around the world as well.
He's fighting around
the world. Making movies, making songs, and fighting around the world. That's what he's most known for, isn't he?
It's a classic. And throwing phones at journalists. Does that qualify as fighting?
He was at one point, I think, when Gladiator had just come out, I think he was the biggest actor in the world for a small window.
Fun fact, you know the opening scenes of Gladiator, where the Romans are fighting the Germanic troops, that was shot not far from Aldershot in Hampshire.
Right. Well, hey, there you go. Like, so they can make anywhere look kind of epic and kind of historical. That's why a lot of films they shoot in Iceland, because the landscape there is just unbelievable and it looks unique, like unlike anywhere else. So that's why, yeah, a lot of movies like get shot there. Aldershot, if you can believe that, everybody. There are other kind of films of that kind of type. I mean, there's quite a few that I'm not going to go into a great deal about them now, but there's a couple of others that I just wanted to quickly mention. There's a German film called Combat Girls that we watched, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, Kriegerin, that was a very good film. I enjoyed that a lot. And actually, it really stands out amongst the other sort of skinhead subgenre films as a film that kind of shows like the feminine experience of being involved in skinhead gangs. Although arguably, you know, Romper Stomper, with the character of Gabrielle, played by Jacqueline McKenzie, is one such portrayal of the feminine experience that was based, according to Jeffrey Wright, on a very long conversation that he had with a girl in a coffee house in Melbourne, where she sort of just poured out this confessional of being involved with the skinhead gang.
And there are other kind of films from around the early 90s in Australia that came out about the same time as Romper Stomper. Romper Stomper was a bit of a weird one because it's a bit of an outlier in kind of like films that came out about the same time in Australia, because if you look at kind of, you know, the 90s to, you know, the year 2000, apart from Chopper and something like Bad Boy Bubby, they're all kind of very happy films, I guess, in a lot of ways, not to kind of stereotype them. But if you look at the kind of the main films that kind of came out around the same time from Australia, you've got The Piano, you've got Muriel's Wedding, you've got Shine, you've got The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, you've got Babe. So these are very different from Romper Stomper, but they all kind of tie together because of, you know, where they're made, I guess, in certain ways that we're going to talk about.
So, can I just ask, would you say The Piano is a happy film?
Right, maybe not, but it's not a violent film, I guess.
Is it not?
The aspirations are different. That's a film that's a dramatic film. So, let me rephrase then what I'm trying to say. Apart from, let's say, Chopper and Bad Boy Bubby and Romper Stomper, which are going for, let's say, a certain end of the film market, you've got a lot of films that are either drama films or comedies, like the films that I mentioned just now. I mean, yeah, these films do kind of stand out. And admittedly, the first three films I said are ones that I'm more likely to be drawn to and watch. I mean, would you agree? I mean, do you think there's something to that?
I would say so. And actually, that's one of the reasons why, you know, this film has become a sort of a timeless classic. It's difficult to think of Muriel's Wedding, for instance, or Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, as anything other than an Australian film.
Or Strictly Ballroom as well. Strictly Baz Luhrmann's Ballroom. Films just generally.
Which I haven't seen. But I was horrified to find that actually his Australia was the second highest grossing Australian film of all time. And that is such an atrocity. I mean, I watched that very recently. I watched that on holiday in my hotel room when I was in Morocco. And, you know, when you're choosing between like different national Middle Eastern channels and a Hollywood block, you know, a Hollywood film that's actually showing, right, you're going to choose the feature film. And it happened to be Australia. And it's just unbelievable. Like, I cannot. It had me rubbernecking it, you know, between kind of switching channels for about what felt like maybe 5 hours of my life. I realize it's not that long, but I cannot believe how much Baz Luhrmann crams into this, you know, hyper real, just overcooked, burlesque stew of a film. You know, it's Rompa Sompa is I think the absolute opposite of something like Baz Luhrmann's Australia. And I think it's in its sense of place that it's very much about, you know, the underbelly of Melbourne in the early 90s. It's almost by situating it in this exact place at an exact time that he's given it a sort of timelessness. You know, it sort of transcends the kind of topography that it's supposed to portray. Like, honestly, you know, it could be almost any large city.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't have to be Melbourne. Although he's from Melbourne. So yeah, that's why his Australian films are set there. So Metal Skin, which is a film that he made just after Rompa Stompa, is a film, again, that we saw very recently. It kind of had in a way, a sort of similar feel of the geography, which it would do because it's set in the same place. So I guess it's kind of, I don't know if there's anything to that other than kind of writing what you know, I guess. So,
well,
unless you think there's more to it than that.
Well, according to some sort of cursory research that I did for the episode, it seems that a lot of this new urban cinema was shot in Melbourne at the time. That's just sort of how it was in Australian cinema in the early 90s. There's something to be said for the fact that between 1989 and 1992, Australia went through the worst economic recession in 50 years. So both the visual language and the themes that emerge in Rompa Stompa, they reflect that. I mean, there was a huge push for the internationalization that came from Australian filmmakers and cultural bodies trying to get investment from France and the US. There was a kind of a big push to feature actors who were not Australian. And in 1989, the public policy of multiculturalism was introduced. I mean, there was a big push for featuring more ethnic minorities on film and incorporating kind of Aboriginal or First Peoples in the Australian, you know, not only on the screen but off the screen, following the Commonwealth Games, which is actually the first time that kind of Aboriginal art was used as part of the international visual branding of Australia. So you do see a lot of these kind of wider forces at play in Australian society, which kind of lends Romper Stomper and its focus on a far-right neo-Nazi gang a very kind of timely, a very palpable urgency, because, you know, these were the reactionary forces, you know, these were the people at the extreme fringes of society who were rebelling against this.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of the film itself, so we talked around it for a while. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give a synopsis this time in terms of kind of what happens in the story, and then I'm going to refer to Miro in a second. So basically, the story of Romper Stomper is that Russell Crowe plays Hando, and he's the leader of a racist gang of skinheads. His best mate is Davey, is played by Daniel Pollock, who unfortunately committed suicide not long after the film had finished. And what happens is they attack Vietnamese immigrants in their area. Particularly, a sore point is that a group of Vietnamese are buying their local pub that they like to frequent. There is a big fight and they get battered, and they have to basically leave kind of their area because they're on the run from both the gang and the police. Alongside this, a girl called Gabrielle, who's played by Jacqueline McKenzie, hooks up with Hando because he's a very stereotypical kind of alpha male type guy. So she's really interested in him. And she wants to get revenge on her abusive father, who is very, very creepy, as we're going to discuss a bit later on. And then, as kind of happens in films like this, you've got a love triangle, so between Hando and Gabrielle and Davey, because Hando eventually gets bored of her and Davey kind of quite likes her. And then, shit goes down big time. So that's kind of the story of the film in sort of my kind of unique kind of style. Now, I watched this film when I was very young, and so I saw this before I saw LA Confidential. So when I saw Russell Crowe in LA Confidential, the role he's playing in that is kind of a very similar character to the one he plays in this film, but I didn't enjoy it as much as you enjoyed it, because you absolutely loved this film, don't you?
I did absolutely love this film from the first moment that I saw it. I used to subscribe to Love Film. Do you remember the DVD rental service?
I had it until the day it died.
I owe so much of my film education to Love Film. And I went through a phase of basically watching a lot of kitchen sink realism. You know, I watched a lot of films like, you know, The Firm and Made in Britain, sort of like, you know, British films from the 80s showing kind of the gritty reality of people, you know, on the edge of society. So, you know, a lot of that kind of was Mike Lee. And then I watched a lot of films about skinheads. I wouldn't say like specifically skinheads, like that sort of flowed out of it, but I watched a lot of Almodovar. I watched a lot of kind of like very violent kinetic stuff. So Amores Perros was another one, you know, Iñárritu. And then I ended up watching, and it sort of kept recommending you things, you know, like if you like this, you might like this. I watched American History X, and then it also recommended Romper Stomper to me, and I was like, okay, well, this looks great. And I watched it, and I was just, I don't know, I was transfixed. Everything about this film appealed to me. At the heart of it, I feel like this is a Shakespearean tragedy. I think the surface of the film, you know, the synopsis, the fact that it's a story about, you know, the demise of a neo-Nazi gang, is is almost secondary to the fact that at the heart of it, this is a Shakespearean tragedy where you have these very stark leading characters and you have bonds of love and friendship that disintegrate and become something truly ugly. And so much of the film hinges on Russell Crowe's performance, which is breathtaking. I mean, he's this charismatic, menacing neo-Nazi gang leader. And I've seen this film a good few times over the years. It's one of those films that I will probably rewatch maybe once a year, simply because it kind of appeals to me on many levels, but also I find that every time I rewatch it, I discover like a small detail that gives me a better insight into, you know, into both the story and the characters. So actually, when we watched it for the podcast, I decided to finally find out what the opera was that Martin, the father, is playing when the neo-Nazis, you know, they do the home invasion and they, you know, they burgle his mansion upon Gabrielle's suggestion. And it's actually, I found out that it's an opera by the French composer Georges Bizet, obviously famous for Carmen. But Carmen was not for another 10 years. This is the Pearl Fishers, Les Pêcheurs de Perles. And actually, the song that is playing is one of the best known arias in Western music. And the opera is set in ancient times on the island of Ceylon, or modern Sri Lanka. It tells the story of how two men's vow of eternal friendship is threatened by their love for the same woman, whose own dilemma is the conflict between secular love and her sacred oath as a priestess. So it's almost impossible not to read into this as being a kind of, you know, mirror reality of what is happening between Hando and Davy as the film goes on. At first, like, we meet Hando at the height of his power, surrounded by, you know, his crew. In fact, the film opens with a violent scene of them, you know, attacking a Vietnamese couple in an underpass near Footscray Station. So, you know, this is kind of violence, a racist violence against essentially, you know, civilians. And Davy is Hando's second in command. And they're very much, they're you know, fighting in inverted commas side by side. So we see both Hando and Davy for who they are from the beginning. You know, it's not like we warm to these characters and then suddenly, oh, we see them, you know, getting violent with some Vietnamese teenagers and they and you know, our image of them is ruined. No, we know exactly what they are from the beginning. And yet we find ourselves watching and almost like rooting for them at different points in the film. And kind of the catalyst to change in their relationship, like in their friendship, is, you know, coming across Gabe, or Gabrielle, Jacqueline McKenzie's character, who is, you know, a troubled young woman who was abused, sexually abused by her father for many years, who is dependent on some kind of pills. Like, we don't really know what it is. Like, we meet her when the police come to arrest her junkie boyfriend and her father intervenes. And she also seems to suffer from some form of illness, like epilepsy. She has seizures, so she's very vulnerable. And we know that she has lost her mother. She lost her mother at an early age. And we know that she comes from a privileged background. So she's this sort of, she's this kind of damaged, precious young thing who keeps, you know, thrusting herself into these dangerous situations. And in fact, you know, she meets, like, Hando picks her up at this pub that the skinheads frequent. She's just kind of sitting around drinking on her own in this kind of insalubrious neighborhood. And Hando notices her and this kind of romance just, you know, this kind of chasm opens, you know, and hellfire.
It's like animal attraction, isn't it?
It's animal attraction, and I think the lasting appeal of this film for me is that very rarely on the screen do you kind of see just palpable chemistry between the actors. And like there are certain, you know, there are kind of certain, let's say, devices or cinematic means of conveying romance. And, you know, that might be, I don't know, slow-mo or kind of backlighting, or it could be like, you know, some sort of romantic melody playing. We don't get this in Rumpa Stomper at all. Like, everything is shown as is, pretty much. You know, there's very little stylization. You know, you do get kind of freeze frames, and you get kind of on-screen text, like when the names of the two main characters are shown, you know, Hando and Davy. Also, you know, the fact that it's Footscray Station, you know, in the very beginning, you get that. It kind of puts you in a certain place a certain time. Otherwise, I would say, like, the editing is pretty much, like, it's very, you know, it's very kind of realistic. So it's very rarely on the screen that you see these very, you can hear, you can feel the electricity, and you certainly have that, you know, with the kind of animal attraction, with the kind of, you know, romance that blossoms between Hando and Gabrielle. And, you know, and that, you know, obviously there is, you know, there's a high and there's a low. Hando, I used to think that Gabrielle was kind of the more, let's say, the vulnerable, the weak character, because she sort of adopts this almost, you know, doll-like, babyish kind of manner. But kind of watching this film recently and also reading about it, I've realized that she is as strong as the other two, albeit using, you know, very different means. You know, she certainly can influence, you know, if power is the ability to influence the behavior of others and the outcome of events, on the course of events, then she certainly has a lot of power in this film. I mean, it's her tip off to the police that leads to the arrest and you know, an execution of most of the members of the gang. It's, you know, due to that Hando goes on the run. It's basically because she gets involved with Davy that Hando sort of takes them both on the run. And obviously, you know, the final standoff between Hando and Davy takes place because Davy is trying to protect Hando from killing Gabe, who set his car on fire, thus depriving him of his means of escape. So, you know, she is not only a catalyst and chaos maker, but she's also a very strong and powerful character. And this kind of brings me back to, you know, the Pearl Fishers. We know that Gabe comes from a privileged background. I mean, you know, her father is a wealthy, sophisticated, troubled man. I actually think in the film he is a film composer, isn't he? But what I've realized is that, you know, Hando, Russell Crowe's character, it is not impossible that he doesn't come from a more privileged background than we let on, because we find him humming the tune from the Pearl Fishers as though he were well familiar with it. And several of the members of the gang, when they're sort of not all, you know, hanging out and cussing and being drunk, they are quite well spoken. So this suggests to us that, you know, this whole neo-Nazi gang thing is not just some kind of blue-collar phenomenon gone out of hand, you know, but that actually, some of the people who join these gangs, they may be coming from a background of education, maybe even a background of privilege, but for whatever reason, they get pulled into this sort of life, as does Gabe for a short time when she, you know, runs with the gang and actually gets involved with the violence.
Yeah, yeah. She's a very interesting character in a lot of ways. I agree with a lot of what you say in that when I first saw it, in the 90s, her character is easy to dismiss as kind of this third wheel character who kind of comes between these sort of two best friends. Mm. But seeing it recently through 2020 eyes, that pun sort of not really intended there, but never mind. She's a lot more manipulative, and she's very good at kind of manipulating Davy than sort of maybe I, you know, would have realized when I first watched this as a younger man. So Russell Crowe's character, Hando, yeah, he's kind of the more obvious, kind of the more charismatic, because he's the leader, so to speak. He's the leader, he's a leader, he's a leader of the gang, man, and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, he's but he gets bored, I think, of her very, very quickly. He kind of sees her as something kind of just to kind of, you know, use and then kind of move on. Whereas with Davy, he's kind of more, I guess, sensitive and a lot more kind of interested in her as a person. And that's kind of one of the things I was going to bring up, is the kind of contrast in the sex scenes between her and Davy and Hando. So the sex scene with her and Hando is a lot more kind of not violent. Violence, I don't mean violent literally, but it's a lot more animalistic and a lot more rugged.
Agreed.
And it's juxtaposed between that and Davy boxing against a punching bag, and the other kind of members of the gang dancing violently to the awesome music that we're going to talk about at some point in this on this show. But you've got that. But then near the end of the film, where Davy and Gabe have sex, it's a lot more kind of romantic. It's a lot more kind of, it's a lot more loving. It's a lot less kind of it's a lot less animalistic. It's a lot more tender, I guess. Not that it's boring, but it's a lot more meaningful. It's a lot less kind of just, you know, here you go and then throw away. So I found that quite interesting. You brought up a lot when you were talking just then. And one of the things that you mentioned was the opening scene of the film where the Vietnamese characters get accosted by Hando and his gang. Now, I thought, having watched this again, that there's a lot in this film that is very similar to like a horror film, like how a horror film works. It's particularly the score, score by John Clifford White, which is really good. It's actually one of the best things in the film. There's a lot in there that to me is very kind of horror inflected. Mm-hmm. So that scene in particular is very, very much like, oh, you've got these scary people who are kind of, you know, being horrible to these kind of innocent kind of passers-by in an underpass. Again, we're tying this back to Irreversible, which we talked about earlier. You know, underpasses are very kind of, you know, they're very scary, you know, because it's dark and you don't really know what's going on and you can't really escape.
Yeah, it's,
you know, you can only escape in two ways. Yeah, but not just that. Near the beginning, there's a scene where Hando throws something, I can't remember from my head, for a window because Gabe wants a jacket. And the score in that is very kind of horror inflected. It uses a lot of kind of high strings, a lot of very atonal kind of sounds in there. And I thought that was interesting. I thought the use of the Vietnamese, when they're being attacked by the gang, and then they all kind of get all their mates to kind of then sort of beat up all the gang and sort of chase them away. That's almost like sort of imagery you get in like a zombie film, I thought. And the way the film looks is quite interesting as well, because it's very blue.
Yeah, that's true.
The cinematography. I don't know if that's deliberate. I don't know if they use colour correction at this point in time. But yeah, it is very blue. I also found kind of the last kind of, you know, the fight scene at the end is almost akin to sort of, you know, the fight between the protagonist and the antagonist, like in a slasher film, where you've got sort of the antagonist who's kind of this unkillable sort of superhuman monster, and he's going after the girl, the final girl, so to speak, and sort of the boyfriend or the lone kind of male survivor then has to kill kind of the villain, the monster at the end. So there's a lot of horror imagery in there. That's probably why I liked the film so much when I was growing up.
Well, according to Luke Buckminster, who reviewed a lot of Australian kind of classics for The Guardian, large chunks of the film were graded in a bluish chroma, open quote, as if there is something off colour about what's unfolding, end quote. So I think that was definitely, definitely intentional, that there is some color grading, and also the way the general look of the film, it's very grainy, it's very sort of, you actually, a lot of the film is shot either by night or in the light of day, so you do get these stark contrasts, and it's almost the scenes that are shot during the day, they are no less tense or disturbing than the ones that are shot at night. So you mentioned the scene where the Vietnamese community, let's put it that way, decides to retaliate against the random kind of racist violence that they have suffered, and they all kind of band together and completely destroy, like they burn the skinhead squat to the ground and chase them away. That takes place, you know, by the light of day, and yet it's no less tense. You know, there's a lot of it's very it has a lot of kinetic energy. There's a lot of running, there's a lot of chases, but there are also the quiet moments. Like one of the quiet moments, for instance, being when Gabe wakes up in Hando's bed for the first time, and he sort of, you know, does his pull-ups and then kind of quietly reads to her an excerpt from Hitler's Mein Kampf. Stranger things have happened, as I like to say. But it's a very intimate moment, but it's an intimacy that is laced with menace. And honestly, there is something very spontaneous, as well as I don't want to say meticulous, because it sounds that would suggest that it's, you know, maybe overwrought, but there's something very, it's a film that is edited at a pace. There's not a scene there that you feel makes it drag, and yet it feels very off the cuff, you know? One reason why, like, Metal Skin, Jeffrey Wright's follow-up to Rumpa Stomper kind of really didn't do it for me was because, like, we talked about this, right? It felt like two films glued together or just jumbled together, and many of the scenes, like, they were completely inconsequential.
Yeah, how I viewed it was, you had, like, this half of that story was just Fast and the Furious, and then you had this other half of the story, which was like an Alan Parker film. It was like sort of Angel Heart or something like that, where you had these kind of weird kind of this girl who's, like, you know, worshipping the devil and kind of killing chickens and sort of just acting very strangely for a lot of the film. It's just very odd. It's like, yeah, it just felt two stories spliced together, didn't really fit, and as a result, the second half of the film really, really dragged until the end, and then the ending was just very, very inconclusive. It just didn't really make a lot of sense. Also, an interesting thing to sort of contrast is that Metal Skin is actually a lot more stylish than Rumpa Stomper. Rumpa Stomper doesn't really have that many sort of stylish flourishes, I would say. There's some editing in there, which is like, there's jump cuts during one scene that I remember, when they kind of get to their new squat where they beat up those drug addicts and they force them out, and then they're all walking towards them. There's some jump cuts there, but apart from the blue tint and some editing choices, it's very earthy and very more realistic, you know, definitely more realistic compared to the TV show anyway, that we watched very, very recently. But yeah.
Well, this is certainly a film that has enjoyed a very, controversial reputation, shall we say. It was staunchly defended by its producer, who record his family's Holocaust story, Daniel Scharf, and said that essentially, you know, this film was about a community of people living in one area and the sort of tensions that inevitably erupted. Jeffrey Wright was quick to respond to criticisms of the film's portrayal of racist violence by saying, if the film is racist, it must be proved to contribute to racist behavior. In fact, there has been a link with racist violence because in 2004, a British prisoner called Robert Stewart bludgeoned his cellmate Zahid Mubarak to death with a wooden table leg at the Feltham Young Offenders Institution. And 2 days before that, he had watched Romper Stomper. I mean, I'm not sure how you would get Romper Stomper in prison. I mean, honestly, that's a
good question.
Something that never quite clear to me. Also, Dylan Roof, the perpetrator of the Charleston church shooting, apparently had, so this is something that took place in South Carolina in 2015, in which 9 African Americans were killed during a Bible study class at a church. This perpetrator had an image of Hando dying on the homepage of his personal website. The anti-Nazi League protested against the film's London premiere, and I believe some of the Australian critics when they initially reviewed the film were quite concerned with its content, and one of them famously gave it a 0 rating. And I mean, I read this online that, like, George Wright tipped a glass of wine or champagne over them at an Australian film event afterwards. Nonetheless, it won a ton of awards, and it's kind of, you know, up there in the kind of Australian cinema pantheon. But to me, Romper Stomper is not just, you know, a film about racist violence or a skinhead film, quote-unquote. It's a film that places its strong characters within the universe, you know, within the, let's say, microverse of a neo-Nazi gang in the early 90s. But, you know, there are other characters within the film, like Gabrielle's father, for instance, whose behavior is, you know, also deserves condemnation, not to mention, you know, a lot of the other stuff that kind of gets hinted at. And, you know, the Vietnamese retaliation, whether or not it's justified, it does, you know, it is violent behavior. So we see this, we see very much a clash rather than it just being kind of one-way violence. And Romper Stomper got made into a TV series, the first episode of which we watched, right? That has some of the original actors in it, and it features a lot of kind of clashes between a far-right group and the Antifa. So certainly the context may have shifted 30 years on, but some of the central themes remain relevant.
Yeah, although I would say the difference between the TV series and the film is that in the TV series, you kind of need, like, to have the far right characters and then the far left characters for the story to work, whereas because there isn't that type of group in the film, yes, obviously they are neo-Nazis, but I actually think the fact that they're neo-Nazis is almost kind of irrelevant to the main story that's kind of going on. Now, to me,
agreed.
I've always thought that the first half of the film worked better for me than the second half. The second half, to me, was a bit I don't know, it was a bit less pointed, a bit more meandering maybe than the first half of the film. But yeah, the fact in the first half of the film, yes, obviously they are Nazi, but that's not really the point. There are people on kind of the fringes of society who feel disenfranchised by the world that they live in. Now, they could just be people who live under extreme poverty, not by choice. I think the feeling that I get from watching Rumpelstiltskin is there is a character who's one of Magoo's mates from Canberra who's not got a skinhead, whose hair's longer, and they kind of sort of antagonise him because his hair's longer and he has to leave because he has to get back to his job and things like that. So it's almost like it feels almost in a way that they're deliberately choosing to live on the fringes of society because they blame society. I think they deliberately choose to be on the dole. They didn't say this outright, but the impression that I got was like they were, most of the gang were kind of following Hando because he's this very charismatic guy, and he's decided for whatever reason to live his life a certain way, and everyone is kind of following him along. It's only in the second half of the film where they kind of decide to, you know, where Hando wants to take it up a level and introduce kind of guns and stuff like that, that a lot of them decide, nah, this isn't for me anymore. And it kind of ties into a couple of things that I wanted to cover. So I have covered Nazi exploitation films on this channel with my good friend Mr. Tom Dunnett Cook, and one of the things that we mentioned in those shows is they're very kind of lazy and very flagrant with kind of the use of kind of Nazi imagery. So you'll be what is purporting to be like a Nazi prisoner of war camp, and there are sort of Nazi swastika flags kind of like scattered around the building as if to say, we are Nazis, basically, which is kind of a ridiculous thing, because as Tom pointed out on the last show that we did on Ilsa, basically the real Nazis would not need to do that because they already know they're Nazis. But I actually think in this context, when Hando is kind of, you know, in his bedroom and he's having sex with Gabe, you know, where he has like the Nazi flag on his wall, he's a fanatic. That is, you know, fan is short for fanatic. So that's literally what he is.
He's a Nazi fan.
He's a neo-Nazi. So yes, he is a fan of kind of that way of life and the Führer and far right ideology and stuff like that. So I actually think it is kind of more pertinent in this kind of film and something like American History X than it is in, you know, Love Camp 7 or, you know, Gestapo's Last Orgy, stuff like that. What do you think about that?
Well, we're talking about two very different things, like films which are said to take place, you know, during, you know, effectively Nazi rule, you know. I think an important distinction should be made between Nazi exploitation films and films about neo-Nazis. It's interesting how the original Nazi imagery gets transposed onto kind of gritty urban realities in skinhead films. Like an example of a film I watched recently about, you know, on the theme is Combat Girls or Kriegerin, you know, a German film that kind of shows life in this just really uninspiring town in East Germany. And it shows people with, I mean, let's say not very bright people hanging out and banding over, you know, watching like original Nazi propaganda films. I mean, this is sort of what a subculture does, you know, a subculture bands around certain imagery, you know, certain music, certain clothes. You know, it's a way of building an identity which is opposed to the mainstream often, and a way of kind of recognizing your own. So the original Nazi imagery is adopted by people in a different historical period, essentially in the present day, and no longer has a direct, direct function as insignia, you know, military insignia, but it takes on a kind of symbolic value. And I think this was tackled in the first episode of the TV series Rumpelstiltskin, where Blake, the leader of a far-right blue group called the Blue Patriots. He talks about how, to him, the past is not just some abstract concept. To him, you know, the past is very much present in different objects, in kind of his awareness of his identity, you know, of his pride. So I guess what I'm trying to say here, the Nazi imagery, that plays a very different role. And we know, of course, that in many countries, including Germany, and now since 2015 in Ukraine, Nazi symbols are illegal. It's illegal to wear them or display them, you know, outside of the context of, say, a museum or an exhibition or a textbook. So that gives these symbols an extra level of appeal to people who are trying to shock or to stand out in some way.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. I mean, they are very, very different films. I'm not suggesting that, a film like Ilse Schiewolf of the SS and Rumpelstomper in any way kind of similar, but it's more the use of the imagery, the Nazi imagery, that is clearly very, very different. And that's kind of why I kind of wanted to bring it up. Another thing I kind of wanted to mention that I thought was interesting, and I've seen brought up in a couple of reviews and kind of essays that I've read on the film, is more the use of the Vietnamese characters in the film. So, and this is me kind of playing devil's advocate because I don't really agree with this as such, but basically the film starts with these Vietnamese or Asian characters, and they are terrorized. And from the way that kind of the film starts, you would assume they are going to be the main characters. And then what happens is, obviously, there's, you know, the big fight that happens about halfway into the film. And you kind of think that these Vietnamese characters are almost going to be more prevalent. But then once the kind of big, big fight happens, they disappear and they are never seen again for the rest of the film. And with any film like this, where you're dealing with characters who are, let's face it, not white, and they are almost faceless characters, they're not really given kind of a personality, they're not really given characterization, they're not giving any depth, you know, the film itself could be possibly accused of racism, because in effect, even though you're not giving, you know, I'm not suggesting this is like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's levels of racism here, people, but at the same time, it's like, okay, well, these people, they're just in the film to serve a function to the plot. They are, you know, in the same way as, you know, people say cannibal movies are racist because the cannibals are just there to serve a purpose and they behave in these sort of what are seen as stereotypical ways. The only interesting thing I think is that kind of what happens at the end of the film, because there's the bus of these tourists who turn up while the fight's going on, while their car is burning, and the film is basically about these people who feel that their place in the world is under threat, and what happens in the film kind of demonstrates that. So anyway, I'm rambling on, but basically, how do you feel about that as a criticism of the film? And do you feel that kind of my point about the film essentially being about how Australia is changing in terms of migration?
Well, is, I think
pertinent.
One of the things that I discovered in the film upon, you know, the last watch was just how much humour there is in the film, and what can be funnier than a bunch of Japanese tourists watching and filming on camera the demise
of
Hando, you know, the white supremacist gang leader. I mean, there's, it's certainly, it's, you know, it's sort of, it's the Asians who have the final laugh in this film, you know, both symbolically and otherwise. And the fact that, you know, we see the Japanese tourists, and this part is subtitled, isn't it? Like when a woman asks a guy, are they okay? You know, so they are concerned, they're showing concern for these three characters who are just at the, you know, they're at the end of their tether, and Hando is lying there with a knife stuck in the back of his neck, you know, a Hitler Youth knife that he gave to Davy is ultimately the weapon that kills him. So it's hardly just, you know, it's hardly a coincidence or just a, it seems very much, it seems very symbolic. And I think that Jeffrey Wright, in writing this film, was well aware of the kind of dramatic irony and the kind of black humour even that emerged, you know. And once the initial shock of, you know, because every time I watch it, like, I know what happens, and yet every single time I find myself kind of on the edge of my seat as it does happen. And I think that was intentional.
Very, very true. I mean, incidentally, I mean, I don't think the film is racist, but I had seen that mentioned, so I thought it was worth bringing up. In terms of whether or not this is a good date movie or a bad date movie, so in terms of it being a bad date movie, obviously you've got the violent aspects of it. You have any kind of film where characters are racist is going to offend certain people who have, let's say, delicate sensibilities. There's obviously sex that happens in the film. There is incest, although you don't know it's necessarily incest to start off with, and it's hinted at rather than full-blown kind of, you know, actual incest. But again, that's kind of a bit of a taboo subject. And you have got, in fairness, the music in the film. Now, the music in the film is very, very full-on. I enjoy the music in the film. I think it's really good for what it does. The songs themselves are very, very catchy. And we have kind of a bit of a unique insight into how the well, how these songs would have came about, let's put it that way, because it's a session band that's performing them. It's not like an actual band that's performing them.
I'm not, you know, this could be an urban myth, but I think the makers of the film did approach several white power bands, but they refused to contribute songs because of, you know, actually, in fact, the film does not portray far-right groups in the best light. So they refused, and so session musicians who sort of tentatively titled themselves the Master Race came up with several
very
catchy tracks in the style of kind of oi music, including Pulling on the Boots, Führer, Führer. What else? Skinhead.
Fourth Reich Fighting Man.
Fourth Reich Fighting Men.
Yeah, those are the main ones in the film. And yeah, it's an homage. It's not an actual band from that scene playing this music, like Miro said just there. Yeah, it's, they're doing a, it's not a pasty, but yeah, it's deliberately done in that style. And yeah, it's now, you mentioned something very, very interesting there that I did want to tackle before we got to the end of the show. Is, as I mentioned on the last show, this ties back into how Hollywood used to be back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. It's what I call the morality clause. So it's essentially, if you have a character who does things that are against the law or somehow immoral, basically they're going to get theirs by the end of the film, because Hollywood didn't want to portray these people in any way as glamorous. So if you robbed a bank or if you killed someone or whatever, by the end of the film you're either going to be dead or in prison, essentially, or at the very, very least you're going to be very, very, very unhappy. And I think it's the same with these kind of films. So what always tends to happen is where you have a character like Hando, for example, who is espousing this kind of far-right ideology, by the end of the film, obviously, he, you know, he can't be in a very happy place, so his gang get entirely beaten up. His place where he lives gets burnt down to the ground. He's on the run from the police. He, you know, he dies at the end. And I guess it always kind of has to be the way. It's the same in all these films. It's the same in, like, American History X. Obviously, that has a very downbeat ending. I can't remember the... Like, This Is England has a very downbeat ending as well. So all these films generally, they never end well, is more the point. And is that kind of a moralistic thing, or is it just like, well, these people are racist, so clearly they can't, you know, that we can't glamorize what they're doing in any way, so hence they all must pay for being racist?
Well, you know, there's that expression, live by the sword, die by the sword, in a slightly different context. You know, if you live a violent life, it is very likely that you will meet your untimely end. So,
and that's very, very
this
true.
This may well be the natural consequence of the sort of paths that these extreme characters are on.
But is it a good date movie or a bad date movie?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to take me on a date and watch this film, I'm game, you know. So it's a good time to rewatch Rumpa Stompa. But I may be the exception. Otherwise, I would say that this is a bad date movie because it is a film about the death of love. Like, ultimately, this is what this film is to me. You know, the fact that the, you know, two out of three main characters are neo-Nazis is perhaps secondary to the fact that they are lost and hurt and just conflicted human beings who are ultimately looking for belonging and a sense of, you know, a sense of community or love in their otherwise, you know, very miserable lives.
Yeah, so maybe not the best date movie if it is, in fact, as Mary said, about the death of love itself. That's probably not going to get you very, very far. Unless you're with Mira, of course, because Mira absolutely loves the film, don't you?
Also, Russell Crowe is just, you know, dangerous. You don't want to be in that position when your lady friend has still got, you know, the image of Russell Crowe drinking milk straight out of the carton, seared into, you know, into their eyelids. So don't do it.
No, it's a very, very dangerous thing. But if, in fact, you are not sort of put off, it is a good film, I think, and Miro thinks, so we do recommend the film. I think as far as bad date movies go, I think it's okay as a bad date movie. We're clearly not in sort of really, you know, there are clearly way, way, way worse films out there as date movies than this one, but I would say maybe it's not for people who are, let's say, easily offended by characters who are racist. Let's put it that way. But if you wanted to own it on DVD and Blu-ray, it is widely available on DVD. It's available across America and all across Europe and Australia. The best version, from what I've been told from DVDcompare.com, is the US Special Edition, which has additional extra features missing from the UK on Australian Special Editions. So there you go. If you're in Region 1, then that's the version to get, or if you've got a multi-region DVD player. It is also available on Blu-ray. It's all-region Blu-ray from Germany, of all places, is ironic. Yeah, that's what you need to do if you want to own Rumpa Stompa. I want to thank Miroslava Hartman once again for joining me on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg, for having me.
Is there anything that you want to plug before I let you go?
I want to plug the washing of hands and
okay,
keeping calm during these times of global pandemic. You know, we will pull through it. I think, honestly, the world is never going to be the same after this sort of experience that, you know, transcends national borders, space, time. I mean, it's something that affects us all as humans. So, you know, just try and show as much empathy and self-care during this time. And hopefully this podcast will come out soon enough to help distract you from the harsh realities of today.
Yes, I totally echo those sentiments. And if you are in isolation or if you're under quarantine and you want to pass the time while you're, you know, at home going stir crazy, then yeah, you can listen to all of my previous episodes of this podcast, including the episodes that I've done with Miroslava, or you can watch some really, really bad date movies, maybe not on an actual date because, you know, we're trying to be safe, social distancing and all that. You know, do it by yourself. That way you don't have to worry about offending anyone but yourself. Everyone stay safe out there. By the time I come back, hopefully the world has not ended and hopefully there is toilet paper available once again in the shops. And I'll see you on, who knows when it is, but the next episode of the Worst Date Movies Ever. Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter and suggest movies for me to review at Worst Date Movies. And don't forget to click subscribe wherever you're listening to this right now to never miss any future episodes of Worst Date Movies Ever.